Hi, I'm Jim Gabe, founder of Citizen Arts. I'm very pleased to welcome you to our newest podcast, Hungary's Cautionary Tale, How Autocrats Broke Democracy. Can you name the heads of state of Poland, the Czech Republic, Austria, and other Central and Eastern European states? How about Hungary? I bet many of you are familiar with the name Viktor Orban. How did it come to be that a man who not long ago was a proponent of liberal democracy in his fabled nation has become the head of what he's called a revolution for a new state, an upheaval that over the past decade or so has turned Hungary from a celebrated model of post-Soviet Western-style democracy into an authoritarian regime that, some assert, has more in common with Russia, that has made Viktor Orban a champion of far-right Christian nationalists in the U.S. and worldwide. Why did this happen? How did this happen? Does Viktor Orban provide a roadmap for authoritarian simpaticos elsewhere? Or is he the godfather of a criminal organization built on conspiracy theories about the European Union, immigrants, George Soros, and others? Does he serve the best interests of his country? Or is Viktor Orban's Hungary a cautionary tale for those who believe in free, representative, multi-political party democracy? To answer all of this and more, Citizen Arts is honored to present a panel discussion with three very knowledgeable, thoughtful, distinguished Hungarians. Zsuzsanna Szelini was a member of the Hungarian Parliament, founding member of an opposition political party, and is a noted academic, author, and foreign policy specialist. She's the program director at the Central European University Democracy Institute and has worked on fostering democracy throughout Europe and elsewhere. Balint Magyar was also a member of the Hungarian Parliament and served as government minister of education. He was an anti-communist dissident and founder of Hungary's Liberal Party. As an academic and researcher, he's written and edited numerous books and articles and been a commentator on political, economic, and education affairs. Borbála Krizsa is a sociologist, oral history researcher, lecturer, author, and documentary filmmaker who focuses on Holocaust memory, memory politics, nationalism, and far-right ideology. The Hungarian Raoul Wallenberg Association awarded her a prize for lifetime achievement and for Holocaust research. You'll find full bios of our panelists in the show notes and at citizenartscreative.org. Welcome Zsuzsanna, Balint, and Borbála in Budapest, one of Europe's grand historical capitals. We're so pleased to have you join us for this podcast. We'll be talking about matters that are of great interest to many of our listeners. Let's start off with a bit of historical background. In 1989, after nearly a half century as a communist state under the thumb of the Soviet Union, Hungary began reinventing itself as a liberal democracy. By that, we mean a political system featuring separation of government powers, an independent judiciary, checks and balances between government branches, and multiple viable political parties. How did that happen? Balint, let's start with you.
Well, it was a negotiated transition from a communist dictatorship into a liberal democracy. Either there was a negotiated way, like in Hungary and in Poland, or it was a retreat, like in Russia, or in other countries there was collapse of these regimes, like in East Germany, Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia at that time, and Romania.
Borbála, do you want to add something to that?
Well, I was quite young, but the impact or the importance of this transition can be measured with the fact that I was in 89, I was 15, and I was active in that, participated. I was in a privileged position because I come from an intellectual family in Budapest. It's often criticized that it was an elite-driven transition. So the elite participated and not, you know, popular. It was not where the whole Hungarian society was active.
Shoshana?
In Hungary, the Soviet leadership was on a decline already in the 80s. A lot of organizations, discussion clubs, or opposition movement were organized. And as Balint said, we had a negotiated agreement with the Communist Party. We got into free elections because the aim of the transition was to introduce multi-party liberal democracy, free and capitalist economic system. And this was all what we actually succeeded, shorter than probably anyone expected just a few years earlier.
Thank you very much for that. I want to step back even more, because when people think of Hungary and its relationship with the Soviet Union, often the revolution of 1956 comes up, which was a very different affair with thousands of people killed and wounded. How had Hungary arrived at a point where it could have a peaceful transition from a point where, and I vividly remember this, seeing the tanks rolling into Budapest?
By the late 80s, the communist system, the Soviet Union, the centralized system was weakened so deeply that it was not maintainable. It was very different in the 50s when it was a growing regime, a more robust system, and a very deep moment of the Cold War. Basically, no support from the West was possible. That was quite different in the late 80s when there was a warming relationship between West and the East. And also the Soviet Union was just not able economically to maintain its regime. I mean, that was the reason the Soviet troops were withdrawn from all countries. The Soviet Union did not have money to maintain them. So that was a very different historic environment.
Here we are, just over 30 years after 1989, what you might call the peaceful change. It was originally in 89 aimed at being a liberal democracy, a parliamentary democracy, a constitutional democracy, all those different words to say basically a similar thing. What is it now?
After 2010, I would define the Hungarian regime as a patronal autocracy, which means one patron-client network practically conquers the whole society and subordinates the rival patron-client networks or liquidates other patron-client networks. This happened after 2010. And a special form of it, a post-communist mafia state. Hungary is that special form of an autocracy when political enterprise practically captures not simply the state, but captures the oligarchs and captures the economy and the market and runs the government as a criminal organization.
I'm actually a big admirer of Balint's theory about this post-communist mafia states that very much describes the situation. I'm not very happy with the description or usage of the liberal, because that just distorts the reality of the current political regime in Hungary.
I think that Hungary is a growing autocracy, which is one man-led political and economic elite. It's very specific for the 21st century, because repression and capture of institutions and the society is possible without violence. And this is why it looks like democracy. It keeps institutions of liberal democracy, but actually it doesn't work as a liberal democracy.
There's a vocal gallery of high-profile commentators, journalists, and politicians on the far right in the U.S., Western Europe, and elsewhere who admire what Hungary's become. They particularly admire Prime Minister Viktor Orban and the Fidesz Party. In 2022, Orban won his fourth straight election. It was a landslide that gave him his fourth straight supermajority in Hungary's parliament. How has Orban gotten so politically powerful, starting with his first election in 2010.
So in 2010, when Orbán received a supermajority, which was actually easy by the Hungarian election law, he announced a revolution for a new state. And within 1 or 2 years, he basically captured all the state institutions and then pushed out various economic actors who would threat in any way the power of this new elite. It was very quick. Orbán actually called this as an all-out attack, which he took from football, when at every field, the government or the governing party, which captured the state, basically started to take over the power at every level of society. And this is happening ever since.
Thank you. So how did this attack show itself? How did he accumulate so much power?
What happened in 2010, because of economic crisis, bad governance of the socialist liberal government, failure of the prime minister, some corruption cases, etc., etc., these created such a political collapse with the help of a disproportionate election system. They could win 2/3 majority in the parliament, even with 53% of the votes. And when this autocratic breakthrough happened, it meant that one single political actor, namely Orbán and his patron client network, alone could bring a new constitution to change the election law 300 times in the next 10 years, always when it was needed for him, he custom tailored to the needs of his own party, and to appoint to the top of the institutions, which should serve as the institutions of checks and balances, his cadres. Such a way, he created a monopoly of political power in the political sphere, and comes after it from, let us say, from 2011, the autocratic consolidation, when he subordinates the different spheres of society, but it's not simply an autocracy, and this is what I would like to emphasize. It's absolutely misleading when we say, for example, that the government decides or the parliament decides, because they are organizations which rubber stamp those decisions which are taken in a ruling elite that has the form of a political economic clan, an adopted political family, which means the abolishment of the autonomous positions of institutions and persons, and forcing them into patron-client relations.
Balint, let me step in here a sec. How was Viktor Orbán and his party able, with the supermajority, how were they able to change the constitution so much that they could get this power? Did the constitution allow for that, or were the constitutional formats simply ignored?
They brought a brand new constitution, and at the same time, they just abolished the right of the Constitutional Court to investigate, to judge the constitutionality of the constitutional changes, so they could change the constitution whenever they wanted. And it happened already, I think, more than 9 times. And this constitution, what they brought, it was brought without any social discussion.
So there is no preordained regulation or control within the Constitution to prevent a political force going with a wholesale change of constitutional norms. In the U.S., it can be extremely difficult to change the fundamentals of the Constitution. You didn't have safeguards in the Hungarian Constitution?
Not at all. If you have the 2/3 majority, then you can change the constitution, all the laws which are under the constitution as well. And since 2015-16, there is practically a rule by decrees, because of the different types of emergency cases, like the migration first, then the pandemic next, and now referring to the war in Ukraine. The government itself can decide about anything and not to take into consideration the different restrictions of different laws.
What was it that happened in 89, 90, 91 when they were developing the constitution, the Hungarian constitution? Why did it allow for so much opportunity, particularly given the fact that there were extreme parties on the right and the left in Hungary. Why did it allow for the kind of leverage that could completely disrupt the system? It almost was an invitation to somebody with autocratic proclivities to step in and start taking things over.
First of all, the constitution in 1989 was a result of the roundtable discussion between the opposition parties out of parliament and the Communist Party, the previous regime. It had always had a little bit of a legitimacy problem. The other thing is that two-third majority is quite a safeguard. The constitution was not changed for 20 years because it was not so easy to change it. Because no one thought that one party can do a supermajority. No one thought that in 1989 when the negotiations were going on. This happened because the election law was so incredibly majoritarian in Hungary, which was also the result of the negotiations. We learned over the years that this election law is so majoritarian that it's too easy to make a big power. The other thing is that the constitutional mindset in Hungary in the, let's say, 2000s is just not comparable to the US system where their constitution was the basis of statehood. Here, there were constitutions for hundreds of years. They were changed a couple of times just in the 20th centuries because regimes were coming and going. It's a completely different history. So touching the constitution did not mean exactly the same in Hungary than in the US. But Orbán still needed a narrative why one party changed the constitution in 2011. And this was a very strong crisis narrative. The 2008 economic crisis was absolutely critical in this sense. This made a landslide victory of Orbán after 8 years not very successful socialist liberal government. Second, he could say that the liberal democracy, as we hoped for 20 years, failed. In 2010, when he won, he said, we are changing now everything because the system between 1989 and 2010 didn't work very well. It put us into this bad crisis. I am here to correct what we did bad and we make a new revolution. So this crisis narrative, which actually Orbán is using ever since, was very, very strong in 2010 to legitimize politically the act that one big party actually changed the constitution. So I think that this crisis narrative is something very important.
One more thing to add to what Bálint and Zsuzsanna said. There was a strategy from Fidesz, which was basically sort of anti-establishment or anti-system attitude. Even if they were in the parliament, they obstructed the work of the parliament. They did not participate. And they started the discourse, which was very discrediting towards all the actors of the Hungarian political arena. It's very important that the rhetoric of this regime, the narratives, the discourse they are using. We talk about populism constructing enemies and dividing the discursive sphere. That's also part of the of this success, besides the electoral and legislative techniques they are using.
Let me ask this. There have been all sorts of polls done throughout Viktor Orban's reign. How much popular support did he have in 2010?
Well, in 2010, Viktor Orban won with 52% of the votes. It's not the popular votes because there are approximately 8 million people in Hungary who have voting right, and approximately 5.5 was voting, and he got 52% of those. But he did have half of the votes because of the majority and system, winner takes all system. He actually got the supermajority on the basis of 52%. I think that's something which resonated in the United States.
In other post-Soviet countries, in Romania, Bulgaria, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and other countries, they have a proportionate election system, and it hampers to have such a concentration of political power on one hand, and on the other hand, what these countries has both the directly elected president and government, which is elected by the parliament, has special rights balancing each other. These things do not exist in Hungary. And even after his first victory, Orbán immediately changed the constitutional law. So next time in 2014, it was enough already only 44% of the votes to have again 67% of the seats in the parliament. And since that time, monopolizing their positions over the Hungarian media and helicoptering a lot of money during the elections, of course, they could repeat this victory and making the election law more and more disproportionate. In 2022, they helicoptered about 3 or 4% of the Hungarian GDP as a present to the voters before the elections. I do not think that any political force could lose the elections if they would have the possibility to mute the independent media and the opposition media on one hand, and on the other hand, just giving as a gift to the voters about 3 or 4% of the GDP just 1 month before the elections.
He muted the media, but he bought enough of a portion of the electorate to guarantee large victory.
Yes, it happened. For example, for those families who have kids, they paid back personal income taxes as a present from the government. He introduced again the 13-month pension, and it was again paid just 1 month before the election. He gave a 6-month salary all the employees in secret service, police and military just 1 month before the elections. And he had a lot of others. He just gave the money. This is why now the economy in such a situation that Hungary has the highest inflation in the EU.
I want to go back to something Borbála said. I'm assuming that what the electorate hears, because the media has been muzzled, are only his stories. They are not understanding that these givebacks created economic problems affecting the country's ability to invest in itself and to grow economically.
The Fidesz party, which is Orbán's party, was always very strong in strategic communication. And now it has built a spectacular communication machinery where there are the media controlled by the regime and its oligarchs. It has also a very strong creative element to bringing up new narratives. And these narratives are usually based on a lot of research and public polling. For example, in the migration crisis, you know, when a lot of Middle East migrants came to a country, which is normally there are no migrants almost at all. It's a very homogeneous society. A lot of people would be worried about that. That's a controversial issue. So Orbán started an anti-migration propaganda story in 2015, which was incredibly efficient. And of course, it was a build-up hatred. We can see the similar thing in Russia's war in Ukraine, which is absolutely horrifying, where normal people, especially in Hungary, in Eastern Europe, you know, are a very strong solidarity with Ukrainians. The government realized that a lot of people are worried about war. So they started to build a narrative. It's called pro-peace. But at the end of the day, it is pro-Russia and practically anti-Ukrainian. And a lot of Hungarians are completely puzzled because morally they would help the refugees and they would support Ukrainians. But the government sees that we want peace, peace, peace with Dresden. And you can see all over Europe now the peace narrative is one which extremist parties are representing. So this the communication machinery is also part of what Balint explained as key tools for maintaining the regime.
What are some of the other stories that he's developed that have built the kind of electoral support he has?
It's quite well designed, as Zsuzsanna put it, with different targets. After the migration crisis, there was a strong anti-Soros campaign. George Soros, the philanthropist millionaire, he was blamed to invite migrants to Hungary and to Europe. So he was able to link the figure of Jewish Hungarian philanthropist who did a lot for Hungarian higher education, and he participated in different public issues in Hungary. And he became an enemy figure, and he represented this foreign Jewish liberal American capitalist who it can be blamed for migration. And then, of course, there was a strong anti-EU campaign. Orban or Fidesz is blaming the EU sanctions against Russia for the economic crisis. He has a very good, as Zsuzsanna said, very good machinery using different tools like sending questionnaires to the citizens. These are in practically propaganda leaflets, and they use boards all over the country to publicize these questionnaires. So these are campaigns targeting enemies and gives like an ideological support to his political strategy.
How did Orban and Fidesz gain so much control over the media? Was the media already captive of certain parties? Was there a true independent media at the time the country became a liberal democracy back in 89, 90? Or things changed dramatically?
I think it changed dramatically. They conquered state media. During the election campaign of 2022, the coalition of the opposition parties got 5% time in the television, no else. All other times were just for government and Fidesz propaganda. They spent on media about 330 million euros from the budget, and another 300 million euros sum was spent for government propaganda in other outlets, the alternative media, and they bought up more than 470 media outlets and concentrated into a foundation which was led by the Fidesz. So with the exception of social media, where the opposition voices still have weight, the opposition has no real weight in Hungary. But going back to ideological questions, Orban regime is not an ideology-driven autocracy. It's an ideology applying, which means that it's using three major ideological panels: God, nation, family. The God is just a moral position, depriving the opponents of moral acceptability and making competing policies undisputable. When he's speaking about nation, it means that we are the nation, and all those who are critical towards us, they do not belong to the nation. And the third one, the family, is used for stigmatizing alternative lifestyles, expanding the cultural pattern of patriarchal domination over the nation.
Is Hungary generally, by its historical nature and development, a conservative country?
Well, the value sets of Hungarians is very typical for other Central Europeans. Socially, this is a relatively conservative region if we compare it to Western Europe, like, you know, Denmark or the Netherlands or Germany or France. Maybe not so much Germany, but definitely the Nordics. But if we compare it to the Balkans or the Eastern neighbors, Hungary is much more progressive. And also Hungary is a very divided society. It's divided between cities and rural by education. We see in every society in the West huge differences between worldview of people in local small settlements or certain regions which are left behind and cities which are multicultural and globalist. And the Fidesz government, which is, as we talked earlier, a divisive regime, communication is to divide people, in this sense, is populist. So in international polls, when there is an average Hungarian, this is very misleading because Hungarians are so really divided.
As you said, Zsuzsanna, that divide often plays out geographically between urban and non-urban areas, which we certainly see in the U.S. as well. Mm-hmm. How much of the electorate in Hungary is outside of the Budapest metro area?
Well, two-thirds. One-third is approximate in Budapest. But it's not only Budapest and the rest of the country. There are a couple of bigger cities, universities specifically. There are like four or five other big cities which are more globalist and I think Hungary is relatively urbanized, for example, compared to Poland. So a lot of people live in cities. Budapest is spectacular, and this is a one big city country. It's not all about conservatives or not, because as Bálint explained, ideology is only part of the how Orbán is supporting his system. There are multiple ways funding people, certain social groups better than others, and also repressing alternatives.
Bálint, I want to go back to your earlier comment where you were talking, you were equating some aspects of Viktor Orbán's and the Fidesz approach to power to the mafia. Mafia is a word that rings a lot of bells in the West, because that's where, for the most part, the mafia, as we know it historically, is located. We have certain ideas of what that means. What do you mean?
There are two basic twin motivations of the regime. One is concentrating political power, and the other is accumulating personal wealth, or the wealth of the adopted political family. When I'm speaking about a mafia state, it means that the structure of the ruling elite has a political economic clan, which means that there is no free entrance and there is no free exit from the political elite, but there is only adoption and expulsion, and it's built up like a clan. The nucleus of such clans in these in a lot of post-communist regimes can be different types. It can be, let us say, like in the case of Fidesz, a bunch of guys from a fraternity house of a university, or like in the case of Putin regime, KGB guys from East Germany and KGB guys from St. Petersburg, etc. And now the autocratic breakthrough in Hungary. One patron client network led by Orbán Viktor as a chief patron, as a godfather, practically. Why I say that he's a godfather? Because his aim not just keeping the political power, but enriching his family, his adopted political family, and those belonging to that. And he does it through the means of illegal state coercion. And this criminal organization practically substitutes the government in Hungary. The chief attorney is also a part of these kind of criminal organizations. Therefore, for such a regime like Hungary or Russia, the stake of the election is not just that whether you are in opposition or in power, but the stake of the election, whether you have an omnipotent power on one hand, or you could be subordinated to legal trials and go to jail. Orbán is a client of Putin because they had a lot of corrupt businesses together, which could be treated as criminal acts, and Orbán has no other choice just to keep his power by all means, because otherwise he should face legal trials. So this regime operates like a criminal organization and practically takes away with state coercion private properties of Hungarian entrepreneurs and rechannels it into the coffins of their friends and clients within their families. For example, they gave into concession the whole highway system in Hungary for 35 years. The water supply system is expropriated from the local governments, and it will go also into concession for 35 years. They finished the tobacco retail selling system in Hungary and concentrated and gave it to their clients just as a state monopoly, etc., etc. Practically, what's going on, that a criminal organization is rubbing out its own nation.
Is Orbán himself being enriched? You mentioned Russia and Putin, and Putin is talked about as being the wealthiest man in the world. Is Orbán part of this criminality?
Of course, his family practically involved. His son-in-law, he had nothing practically when he married the daughter of Orbán. Now, among the richest men in Hungary, and then, of course, his family and his father, etc. Orbán himself can decide whom to sell, whom to give this or that part of their property. And it's absolutely obvious, and it's seen in the Hungarian press, and there is a lot of description about it.
We're having a very frank discussion. We could not have a discussion like this with our colleagues and friends in China. we do some work in Russia. We could not have a discussion like this in Russia. How can we have it with you, given that Orban has so dominated the power scene on so many levels in the country? Why do you feel you have the freedom to discuss so frankly with our group these points?
Well, I'm an independent person and can speak freely. I think Orban is not persecuting oppositional figures in a classic way. He has much more clever ways to do that, to take the space away from the opponent views and voices. Probably he would think, if he listens to this podcast, that it will not endanger his position. Sorry to say that, Jim, but this is not something which can be...
We're not going to bring down the regime.
A big threat to the regime. But he knows what can be the threat. And it was already discussed how he is silencing the print media or the TV channels, or there is no public radio station where opposition can appear. So there are more clever ways to restrict freedom of speech.
That this is a very important question. In an electoral system, one party can collect the votes of 2.7 million people. It has supermajority if the other parties are fragmented. And this is the case with Fidesz. There are strategies to maintain the fragmentation of the opposition. And definitely Balint Borbál and I are not specifically dangerous for the regime because we are not active in current politics and we do not represent big masses and we do not have much money. If we had any of this, we would be more dangerous. We would probably face more repression. This peaceful profile of this regime is possible because there is no significant resistance. And the reason is a very relevant question, why don't Hungarians revolt? Why aren't they all the time on the street? Is because there is something very interesting in Hungarian recent history, namely post-1956 revolution, where the communist regime tried to achieve a level of well-being of Hungarians that they don't want to go to the streets. And this was called like Gulash communism, which means that no one from the regime entered to a private life. The only thing was that you don't want it to be active in politically. It was even called like a agreement, social agreement. If you don't want to deal with politics, I take care of you. And this is exactly what Orban is repeating. Now he can do this until economy goes well in Hungary. And in the last 10 years, Hungary was so developed because the European Union went through a huge growth and Central Europe, like 5-6% of growth. And we had so much financial transfers from the EU, which was historically never seen before. It's free money like the Marshall Grant to European countries. So we had a very successful period economically. So Orban could manage this redistribution to certain groups. This is a very important element of the relative peace in Hungary and the lack of resistance and the complete apolitical attitude of many Hungarians, because life is actually acceptable and repression on media, on political actors, on political alternatives is not true for the whole society. And this is why we can talk freely. You know, our voice is not heard in Hungary. Anyone can speak freely in Hungary, but you cannot get into the news. That's very smart way, as Borbála said, of managing. But this can last forever. It only works in good economy. And of course, now we have 25% of inflation because, as Balint said earlier, it's partly because it was so seriously overspending before the last year election. So Hungary is actually facing huge problems by its own political and economic mismanagement. Plus, we are also very deeply and strongly cornered now by the European Union, not only because Viktor Orban's government is behaving in this very peculiar and shameful way vis-a-vis the war in Ukraine, but also because the EU is now withdrawing significant funds from the Hungarian government. So it's under pressure from outside, and there will be a growing pressure from inside as well. This oligarchic mafia structures, which Balint described, I definitely True, but I don't think that they are so easy to maintain in the long run. It looks very robust, but it's led by one person only. There are no big forces behind Orban. And if he's not there with his personal charisma, the whole system might not work, which is a hope for the future.
Picking up on what you just said, Zsuzsanna, he's got these political skills, at least in the Hungarian framework. He knows how to work the system for his own end and for those who support him. A formidable politician, yes?
No one denies that he's a talented politician. But the problem with Orban is that he doesn't really have moral integrity. If he had, we wouldn't make Hungary an autocratic state. And also, he's an incredible risk taker. He is experimenting with himself. He was experimenting with his party. He made huge changes in his political profile. And now he is experimenting with the country. So all the risks he is ready to take is now with the entire country. We are playing with, you know, our membership with the European Union. I mean, these are incredible risk taking. The problem with this type of leaders, whether they are smart or not, you know, they really don't see the limits. I think that Orban is miscalculating oftentimes because not everyone is like him. He can play well with those who he believes are similar. But for example, he definitely underestimated the behavior of the Ukrainian people in this war, the behavior of European elite in terms of standing by Ukraine.
Is there anything approaching a political opposition that could move the needle back toward a true electoral democracy?
I am very pessimistic whether with electoral methods of this government and this criminal organization. One word about the nature of the censorship. During the communist regime, they tried to control the content of the messages and communication. Now, in this type of autocracy, he does not mind the content, he minds the outreach. So I can sing in my bathroom freely, but I could not get onto the stage, you know, with a wider media. For example, even in the only more or less critical TV channel in Hungary, where I used to be invited every second, third month, you know, for political discussions, since 3 years, I am not allowed. I do not like that type of reasoning that Orban is such talented, he's a great guy, etc. Most of the autocrats and dictators, they are talented. Without some talent, they should not be dictators and could not be autocrats. This is not that context in which we judge him, you know. He's an uninhibited guy. He uses all the means what he has to blackmail institutions, persons, etc., instead of normative, formal relations within the society, he transforms practically all relations into blackmailing opportunities. This is how a criminal organization is working in a society. So while in Poland, you know, where we did not have an autocratic breakthrough yet, there are chances that the opposition parties could win elections. In Hungary, it's practically unimaginable. And this is a real problem for the European Union as well, because when an autocrat is within the EU, it's really a difficult question how to negotiate with a criminal. Let's just think about Sweden's joining to the NATO. Of course, he practically has nothing problem with that. Just he wants to use this opportunity to blackmail the EU to give some more money and to finish withdrawing and keeping back that money what the EU until now gave to Hungary, which amounted about 4-5% of the GDP in 1 year, which is about 8-10% of the budget, which is a huge money. It's a real challenge for Europe.
What point are we at? Everything has its cycle, its period, including Fidesz and Viktor Orban. What point are we at?
I think that Orban was at his peak in 2019 because that was the high time of Hungarian economy. Ever since, it's actually declining power. You can see with how desperate they are to get money from the European Union. I think this isolation of Orban's government within the EU is definitely visible. And I'm just not believing that this can be changed by them ever again. You know, the trusts have really evaporated.
Orbán has alienated his support in the EU. He's playing them and using their funds. Is there a potential for Hungary to become more like a Belarus within the Russian sphere?
I have to state no. Belarus has been living on very cheap Russian resources for decades and read on. There is some dependency on Russian energy in Hungary and other deals, but we are not a post-Soviet country like Belarus. It's culturally, it's completely different. We have to compare Hungary to the European countries. Hungarians would definitely not want to leave the European Union. Orbán doesn't want to leave the European Union. And this, there is very straight reason why. There is no alternative for Hungary to be culturally and economically out of the European Union. We are not friendly with Russia. Orbán makes deals with Russia, but that's not friendliness. There is no historic friendliness between the two countries. This regime is playing with EU membership and EU criticism, as Borbála said earlier, a very sharp blame game. Orbán blames everything, you know, the victimhood feeling is very easy to play with. All politicians are doing this. American presidents can play with this. Most powerful people in the world can play victim. It's quite ridiculous, but it's working.
Just adding one point to what Zsanna said, the public support of EU membership is very high in Hungary. So that would be another reason for Orbán not to consider leaving the European Union.
How about Orbán as a reliable member of NATO? Let's say NATO was at a point due to Russian aggression, if you will, where action was called for and everybody is supposed to respond. Let's say Russia invaded Poland. How could Hungary react?
Hungary, under the leadership of Orbán, is an unreliable member of the NATO and for the EU. He is practically a Trojan horse of Russia. And when Orbán is speaking about the necessity of sovereignty and national sovereignty, it does not mean anything else for him than the impunity of his regime. So I think he can play with these cards to undermine the decision-making. In the case of Eastern autocracies, the natural resources, oil reserves, gas reserves, could maintain economically these autocracies. Now our oil reserves and gas reserves are the EU funds. The EU, for a long time, practically financed an autocratic regime. Now I think the EU realized that this thing cannot be maintained because practically they nurture the maintenance of autocracy in Hungary. The situation is very delicate for Orbán because our relative position with other East European countries is declining. Now, practically only Bulgaria and in some respect Romania is behind us in the European ranking in GDP, salaries, etc., etc. So without EU funds, he will be in a difficult situation. Maybe such an economically difficult situation can be the base of changes, but it's a real question whether the changes can be peacefully managed or not.
I disagree with Balint in this. Hungary, under Orbán, always complied with every NATO steps. We even raised financial contribution more than other European countries much earlier. We complied with all NATO rules. And also, actually, we have complied in most important European issues until recently. The problem is that while NATO is very straightforward on security, the European Union is a gathering of nation states. So the rules within the EU are much more complicated, and Orbán could play around with this. But in NATO, Hungary always played the game properly until with Sweden. I actually believe that Hungary is a reliable partner in NATO. If there was anything with Russia and Poland, Hungary would go to protect Poland. I suppose Orban believed that this case would never happen. And I think he is calculating well, because everyone in the NATO, including the Americans and the Germans and whoever, is absolutely critical that there is no real clash with Russia. I think it's not so complicated for him to comply with, because that's everyone's interest.
Let me mention that in the case of Ukraine, since 2016 or 17, Orban made it impossible to have a joint meeting of NATO members and Ukraine and an official meeting and negotiations. Now the NATO said, I do not mind, what are you saying? I will negotiate with Ukraine as NATO and not individually, as individual states. When the NATO tried to coordinate the common purchase of weapons within the NATO countries and the EUs. Of course, Orban does not want to be a part of it, because they are making in this business as well just corrupt bilateral businesses. Of course, we hear all the time that some sensitive informations are kept back from Hungarian diplomats, so they won't be leaked out to Russians. Hungary now is a base of Russian spies. For example, the International Investment Bank, this is practically a Russian spy bank, as we call in Hungary. All other countries from Eastern Europe already left this bank, Czechs, Bulgaria, Poland, etc., etc. And now Hungary remained. When Orban emphasizes that Hungarian-Russian relations are needed to have a safe supply of gas, then it became clear that Hungary bought at the highest price Russian gas in whole Europe. These are corrupt businesses which ties Orban to the Russian leaders. And if you have such corrupt businesses, you are not a free man. You are a client of Putin. It's not so easy to get out. Therefore, Orban, of course, playing his peacock game, you know, peacock dance, that one step here, one step there. He's not a free man anymore. And therefore, he has to be very sure to save his power at any cost.
The next time I'm in Budapest, in a restaurant, maybe it's a little bit exciting. I might be part of a spy movie or something. As I eat my goulash, I better be careful what I say.
Starting in 1989, Hungary set up the institutions, the processes, the freedoms to function as a representative democracy with multiple viable political parties. You gathered steam, you were underway. Many believers in liberal democracy worldwide were applauding Hungary. But now you describe your extraordinary nation as being perhaps at best a populist autocracy, at worst a corrupted criminal state, a mafia state. What do you think is most important to understand about how this could happen?
I think that it's very important to watch the political language. If there are parties which are basically using divisive, polarizing language and using friend and enemy kind of approach, that is, I think, a warning sign that something is really bad. And you have this in many, many countries. Because if one party wins bigger, then suddenly this can be used to undermine every other political or civic movement and delegitimize that. I think it always makes sense to watch like very mission-driven political figures, especially who are saying they are Christian. Most of the far right and radical right groups and organizations use Christianism as their kind of trademark without having the moral basis, only using the hierarchy and those values, which are conservative values, which Violent was mentioning earlier. I think there is a fine line between conservatism and the far right, which is using and abusing the Christian. I think also it's very important to keep free speech and just trust that, you know, independent media is important. This is super difficult because fake news, disinformation and conspiracy theories are everywhere. Of course, all autocrats use conspiracy theories.
I would add the importance of the civil society and how we should not underestimate the role of the democratic actors in a society. They really need to be supported. And especially in fresh democracies like the East European countries, we didn't have too much experience. Right after the political transition, we had just a short period of time, and there were some nice initiatives, but they could not be supported and financed and kept alive. And now there is a lack of sources. I already mentioned George Soros, how he was able to contribute to the political transition. His support was very important to be successful with the regime change. He was very much present in the 90s, but during the EU accession, he withdrew from Hungary. I think that was part of the collapse of the liberal civil society.
I would have to mention two institutional guarantees for avoiding autocratization and the monopolization of political power by a single political force. On one hand, the proportionate election system, and on the other hand, divided executive power. These are the lessons from the post-Soviet regimes. If you have a proportionate election system, then the chance that one single political force, without the consensus, without opposition forces, could change the constitution alone, it can be minimized. Of course, it can occur, but it's a very rare thing that if it happens. The divided executive power between a directly elected president and the government elected by the parliament makes it possible that these two forces can balance each other in the executive field to avoid again the concentration of political power.
I would like to say something positive, because, I mean, talking of Hungary is really, really very depressing. But I would like to quote Viktor Orban. He told his journalist speaking on Russia that even manipulated elections can be lost. Now I think that there is no regime which lasts forever, because the world we are living is so heavily changing all the time. I think there is much more room for change in Hungary than probably decades ago.
One other thought came to mind, so hang in there with me. There is a lot of press here in the States about the reception that the U.S. ambassador to Hungary has received. He is gay, and some of the response has been explicitly negative. Has there been a change in the areas of individual rights when it comes to matters of gender or sexual preference?
I think in this sense, Hungary is, as I said earlier, it's partly very progressive and globalist and partly rather conservative. When Orban is speaking about, you know, anti-gay or anti-LGBT talk, it's for his low-educated, very conservative public. He needs this votes because the party was radicalized over the last 10 years and he lost a lot of support from the center. I don't think he's represented the entire country. The gender talk, as in other extremist parties, is used in political discourse. But I don't think that there is so far very huge influence of this on Hungarian society.
Thank you. Okay, well, I want to end on a positive note as well. Hungary is a gem of a nation in terms of its historical cultural development. There have been some dark blots on its past. We know what they are. Every country has them. But Hungary is a country with, because of its intellectual force, its ability to be self-critical, it seems to me an enormous potential. I can't tell you the number of people I've met who have connections to Hungary. It's a small country that packs a wallop. It's quite amazing. I think you are exemplary in your representation of the thoughtfulness and depth of the Hungarian people. We tend to live in a world of stereotypes, and you get us past those stereotypes. So I want to thank you for this discussion. You've been very forthcoming and very knowledgeable and very informing.
Thank you very much.
Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye, everybody.
There you have it, dear listeners. Our Citizen Arts podcast, Hungary's Cautionary Tale, How Autocrats Broke Democracy. We hope you found this conversation with Zsuzsanna Szalini, Balint Magyar, and Borbála Krizsa enlightening. And we hope you'll check out our expanding range of programs, podcasts, documentaries, and our audio versions of dramas and novels. At Citizen Arts, we're dedicated to presenting information, analysis, constructive opinion, and entertainment with an emphasis on matters of civic importance. We're a not-for-profit 501c3 organization. Your interest in and support of our work are greatly appreciated. Please take a moment to subscribe to this podcast. There are no obligations. On behalf of Zsuzsanna, Balint, and Borbála, and Citizen Arts colleagues Jill Gabe, our executive producer, and Jeff Lewis, our project producer and technical guru, a heartfelt thanks for listening. We invite you to join the conversation. Please visit citizenartscreative.org and let us know what you think. And always, please stay healthy in mind and body, wealthy in goodwill, and wise in action.